The Jodcast. Insert witty comment here. From the National Astronomy Meeting, Day 4.
Hello and welcome to Day 4 of the National Astronomy Meeting from Preston in the UK. And with us today we have David Boyce.
Hello.
Neil Phillips.
Right.
We have Megan Argo.
Hello.
And of course me. We've got quite a few things lined up for you today. We've been off interviewing everyone that we could possibly find. We have Mike Lockwood talking about the sun. We have Ruth Bamford talking about deflector shields. We have Matt Griffin talking about the Herschel telescope. Martin Barstow talking about the Hubble Space Telescope. Peter Wheatley talking about exoplanets. And Chris Lintott talking about astrochemistry and the sky at night. So, what have people been to?
Well, today, one of the major themes of the day was it was a sort of facilities day. Everyone was talking about their telescope or the telescope that they were involved in or their facility, and quite a lot of the day was dedicated to these sorts of things. So that's why most of the talks today are people associated with certain projects.
Is it possible that the reason that you thought everybody was talking about facilities is because you went to the current the future facilities session to remind me of the others?
That could have been it. Yeah. So we've seen some very interesting talks today. We had in the morning, in the plenary sessions, we had Emma Bunce talking about the magnetic environment around Saturn, and we also had Mike Lockwood, who was talking about the radiation of the interplanetary medium. Basically, yeah. In other words, that means, is it safe for humans to travel in space without getting fried?
I think that was a really interesting talk, wasn't it?
It was. Entertaining, yes.
Well, I think everyone secretly wants to be astronauts, and
everyone
was just weighing up whether or not it was worth it.
You talked to Mike Lockwood earlier, didn't you?
I did, and he had quite a lot to say.
Would you like to give us a run over of what you've been talking about today?
Okay, well, the basic idea is that there's a lot of interest in manned flights of discovery outside Earth's magnetic field. This magnetic field, however, does give us some shielding from some fairly nasty radiations that are out there in space. And the sun has a key role in those radiations. It provides a shield that shields us from galactic particles, galactic cosmic ray particles, which are you don't want to be exposed to. But at the same time, the very features of what the sun emits, transient events, structures that come out from the sun past all the planets, those features not only shield us from cosmic rays, but they unfortunately generate their own type of energetic particle. We call them solar energetic particles, or SEPs. And these are also very damaging to people in space. So there's a lot that we need to know and understand and be able to predict about the medium if we are going to safely explore our solar system.
You mentioned that events from the sun could have affected the Apollo astronauts previously. Do you know what the situation is going to be at the timescales when we're thinking of going back to the moon? Is it going to be solar maximum, and what would that mean for the astronauts?
Okay, well, there are choices to be made here. The galactic particles are continuous. They're modulated every 11 years with the solar cycle, and we now know modulated on an 80 to a 90-year cycle as well. As they go down, the total flux of these other particles from SEP particles that the sun, the structures that come out of the sun that they produce, they go up. And we have reason to suspect that they're going to become less of a problem. The real problem is the really large events. The really large events are virtually unpredictable. They come along at all phases of otherwise solar activity. So although you can behave predict the average behavior, the one-off events are going to need real-time monitoring, and when they happen, you're going to have to act very, very quickly.
When would you go? Yeah. If you were going to go into space, when would you go?
Well, I'd probably pass out in the rocket going up the side, because I'm not good with heights. But to answer your question, the general idea is that you can't spend your life in a shield all the time, and because the cosmic ray radiation is continuous, a better thing to do is to go at solar maximum, where you get the maximum shielding effect of the sun from cosmic radiation, but take evasive action And I guess you're asking me to put my money where my mouth is. My science is in the business of making good predictions of when these events are. And quite literally, one's life would depend on those predictions in space. There are, as well as saying, okay, this is a hostile medium and we need the predictions to make sure we're not out and exposed at bad times, there are means that we're thinking of providing shielding. This could be a combination of traditional radiation shielding. The danger with that is the really damaging particles are very heavy and very energetic. So we talk about ions and things like that. They will, when they hit a shield, they'll produce a whole load of secondary particles that themselves are fairly nasty. So you might need a layered approach. But the trouble with traditional shielding revolves around mass. And it's going to be very, very expensive to take a lot of mass into space. So smarter means of doing it, and one example is there's this idea that's been talked about at this meeting called mini-magnetospheres. Now, that's actually not a very good title. We wouldn't deflect particles away with a magnetic field because the gyro radius problems. The gyro radius of these harmful ions is huge. But you could actually repel them with an electric field. So if you had something whereby the particle produced an electric field as it tried to penetrate it and was then repelled, then you might be able to provide at least some form of shielding. And we know we can do this for the relatively low energy particles. Can we do it for really the really nasty high energy particles? And I think the way we'll actually cope in the end will be a combination of clever strategy, right timing, traditional lead-type shielding, and then some smart plasma shielding as well. But we're going to have to do something, otherwise, sooner or later, we will lose a whole craft full of people, basically.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Mike Lockwood from the Rutherton Appleton Laboratory and Southampton University.
Mike Lockwood was talking about the sun and its effects on people. Now, one of the things he also mentioned was about shielding that you could use on a spacecraft. He was saying you need multi-layered shields and you have to perhaps take lots of water as a final defence against all these high-energy particles from the sun. Now, I talked to Ruth Bamford, who has made the international press, because she has a fantastic headline for her research, which was titled Shields for the Starship Enterprise, a Reality. That was with a question mark at the end. And it's basically making a magnetic bubble to protect your spaceship. So let's find out what she had to say. Okay, I've caught up with Ruth Bamford of the Rutherford Appleton Laboratories.
Correct, yes.
You've been on the BBC News website, you've been in lots of newspapers the last few days. Your story was something about Star Trek-style deflectors. What's all this about?
Well, what we're planning on doing at the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory is doing an experimental investigation of the feasibility of producing a little magnetosphere around spacecraft.
So a magnetosphere is like a magnetic bubble?
Yeah, it's like a magnetic bubble. It's the how the Earth's magnetic field, when it goes out into space, and it forms a bubble, as you quite rightly say, around the Earth and protects the Earth from a lot of the solar radiation impacting in our direction.
How would you go about building a small one on a spacecraft?
Well, we're hoping to borrow a lot of the skills and knowledge from the people in magnetic confinement and fusion. There's 50 years of experience there to draw upon in order to create little magnetic bubbles. They do this in the laboratory in order to keep a plasma inside a vacuum vessel, and that plasma they're trying to heat up to temperatures where they can get nuclei to fuse. And
this that's millions of degrees.
Millions of degrees. It's actually a lot hotter, more energetic plasma than we're trying to hold out, and they're trying to hold it in. And if you have ever seen any pictures of the JET or Mars tokamaks that are in Oxfordshire, you can see there's this very hot plasma. It's kept away from a vacuum vessel wall with only a few centimetres between a stainless steel at room temperature and this extremely hot and dynamic plasma.
That's very impressive.
It is very impressive, and we're just hoping to just essentially do the opposite. They're trying to keep it in, we want to keep it out. And that's what makes us very confident that we can actually do this. We don't even need a magnetic field as strong as they have we need a relatively small field of only 50 nanoteslas or so.
Right, so in context, what's 50 nanoteslas in terms of everyday experience?
Well, if you think about the Earth's magnetic field at sea level, the field that makes your compass needle twitch towards the north, the field out in space is a lot smaller than that. It's about six orders of magnitude less.
So a million times less.
Yes, so it's a very weak field, in actual fact. And what we are actually using is not just the magnetic effect of the magnetic field, it's the fact that there's charged particles who like to stay with that magnetic field and orbit around it, the plasma, and the matter coming from the sun in these famous coronal mass ejections of solar proton events, that is a plasma, it's an energetic plasma, which is the radiation that is damaging to human health and to electronics. So we're using a plasma on plasma interaction. We're holding back a plasma with another plasma that we have controls of. And that's an extremely efficient way of doing it. And it's not... We're not where it's a force field is. It's a force field we all know about. Mm. It's not a new branch of science being discovered.
Yes.
It's electrostatic forces between positive and negative charges, and a plasma acts as a collective beast, where those charges keep all the particles in communication with each other.
Right.
And they essentially form a continuous force field or a mesh.
Right,
by keeping hold themselves together.
So you'd have that sat on the sun side of the spacecraft then, presumably?
Yes, in some configuration, some design, maybe in a cluster of satellites, or maybe a single surrounding a spacecraft that holds the astronauts, or maybe we have a donut-shaped spacecraft or something like that. Those are essentially details to be worked out with all the other aspects of building a spacecraft to go to the moon. At Mars and just stay there. I have to be sorted out a lot later. First of all, we've got to find out if we can get it to work and get it to be optimum, and what kind of engineering we need to do. And so that's the source of the research project that we're doing at Rutherford.
Right, so what are you actually doing in the lab?
Well, we've been doing some computer models for a couple of years, but it's computationally complex to study this interface of these two plasmas,
right,
because you can't use simple assumptions that this plasma, collective plasma, is a fluid. You've got to go down to looking at the interactions, the responses of the individual particles. So you've got to start talking about particle in the box.
So a lot of millions of particles.
It's computationally incredibly complex to have not only the kinetics of the particles as with mass and charge, but how all these charges at a distance interact with each other. And you've got to forget the very important magnetic field, which is essentially guiding where they go, how they behave, whether they go across the field lines or not.
And presumably they influence the magnetic field as well.
Yeah, it's a two-way process, very much so. So it's a complex beast, all right,
yeah.
But it's one which has been worked on to a tremendous extent all around the world, not least in laser plasmas, astronomical plasmas, and most poignantly for our purposes, magnetically confined plasmas,
right,
where they've been trying to get the engineering right to actually... guide these magnetic fields in the right configuration to create a force field, as it were.
So what sort of timescale do you expect you might have something working in the lab?
We'll have an experiment. We're actually going to borrow an experiment from the University of Manchester, the Plasma Physics Group, which is actually a linear plasma device which was developed for studying certain aspects of how the plasma in a tokamak hits material.
Mm.
But that flowing plasma is a linear device. That's a solar wind in a bottle. And so we're going to put some items in its way to look at trying to hold off that flow and do some proof of principle experiments, and we should be able to do that in the next 6 months. And then we're going to move that equipment, we're going to borrow it and take it down to the Rutherford. We can find our feet in the experimental world of mini magnetospheres, and after that we hope to be building a large scale version in the very large tank that there is for satellite testing at Rutherford. And after that, we would hope to be investigating technologies like superconductors and the like. So it's a long-term program, but it's all doable.
Well, it sounds fantastic, and it brings all the Star Trek-style technologies a bit closer to now.
Well, there's many aspects of Star Trek, of course, were not just plot devices designed by the writers of Star Trek. They got a lot of advice for scientists and consultants from NASA. So they were well aware of what's doable. And we all know that the archetypal Star Trek devotee who will pick them up on any little detail that is not not doable. So there's no coincidence that fact is following fiction.
Well, thank you for talking to us on the Jodcast.
Thank you very much.
That was Ruth Bamford from Rutherford Appleton Laboratories.
Today I spoke to Matt Griffin, who is involved in the Herschel telescope. Now, the Herschel telescope is going to be a space-based sub-millimeter telescope. Now, what that basically means is that between infrared and radio, you get this sort of this section of astronomy that's not normally, you know, hasn't had a lot of coverage. But we think there's a lot of interesting things that can be found at this wavelength. And I was talking today to Matt Griffin from the University of Cardiff, who actually works on one of the instruments of the Herschel telescope, and he was telling me about some of the plans for the mission. I'm now talking to Matt Griffin from Cardiff University, who has just given an excellent talk about the Herschel telescope. Could you tell us a little bit more about that, Matt?
Well, the Herschel telescope is one of the major cornerstone missions in the European Space Agency's science program. It's a very large observatory, costing a total of about €1 billion. And it's put together by ESA and by many European space agencies providing the instruments. And I'm responsible for leading one of the consortia building one of the three science instruments that will fly on Herschel.
So you said in your talk that you were expecting a launch 31st of July 2008. How likely is that, do you think?
Well, as with all space satellites, the launch date is always hard-driven in terms of schedule, and one has a target launch date, which can be met if everything goes well. In reality, there are usually a few delays for one sort or another, so it launches shortly afterwards. But everybody's aiming for 31st of July 2008, and if we don't meet that, it'll go up very quickly afterwards.
How does this telescope compare to the James Webb Space Telescope, which is also infrared telescope?
Well, when Herschel is launched, it will for a time be the largest astronomical telescope ever flown. It's not as big as the James Webb Space Telescope, but it will go up first. But more importantly, it operates in a different part of the spectrum. The James Webb Space Telescope operates at optical and near-infrared wavelengths, which are very useful for observing stars and galaxies in their quiescent periods. Herschel will operate at longer wavelengths, and this will allow us to see inside clouds of gas and dust in which new stars are forming, both in our own galaxy and in distant galaxies. And we will be able to see things that JWST can't see, because literally the activity is obscured from its point of view. So the two observatories together will allow us to see the whole of a galaxy, the stars that already have formed and the stars that are still forming.
Matt Griffin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Matt Griffin from the University of Cardiff.
David, talking about missions in space, I think you caught up with someone else who's involved in the space mission as well.
Yes, I spoke to Martin Barstow today from the University of Leicester, and he was telling us about the repair mission to the Hubble Space Telescope, with specific reference to the UV astronomy that he is interested in. And he had quite a lot to say about it. I'm now joined by Professor Martin Barstow of the University of Leicester, who's just given a talk in the Future Missions section, and he spoke about the future of UV astronomy, focusing on the Hubble Space Telescope. Soon, the Hubble Space Telescope will hopefully be repaired, and some UV capability will return. What do you have to say?
Well, it's not just about the UV, it's about all spectroscopy, because since the Space Telescope Imaging Spectrograph failed, there hasn't really been any good quality spectroscopy available on Hubble at all, in the UV or in the optical. So it's very important for them to put on the new instruments, which is including COS, Cosmic Origin Spectrograph, which is a UV-only facility, but also there's a plan to repair STIS as well. On the other hand, with the failure of the ACS, it's also going to be essential to put on board the Wide Field Camera, which is the new imaging camera, and we hope they're going to fix ACS as well. There's a plan being developed right now to repair ACS. It's a bit like giving it a heart bypass. They're going to build a new power supply and actually put the power supply on the outside of the instrument and strap it across the various parts of it to provide new power.
A very recent press release by NASA on Hubble suggested that the batteries will only just last until the repair mission, with
a slight amount of uncertainty on whether or not the batteries would last at all until the repair mission. What are your feelings on the probability of the mission?
Well, the batteries were decaying, but that seems to have slowed down and almost stopped. So I think the issues about the battery survival in the short term are not very much much of a problem now. But it is going to be important to replace those batteries during the repair mission. But one of the complexities is do you replace the batteries that are up there now with old batteries that you're reasonably happy about, or do you buy new ones? And have you got enough time to test them beforehand? Because obviously the batteries that have been sitting on the ground as spares have been around for a long time now.
You're also heavily involved in the World Space Observatory. How's that coming along?
Well, that's going very well at the moment. All the various aspects of the World Space Observatory are almost secure. The Russians are leading it and have put it into their revised space program with a launch probably around 2012. And all the instrument systems are going to be provided by various partners in Europe, and the Germans, the Italians and the Chinese have also signed up to provide some components of that. We hope the UK will be involved in the Chinese long slit spectrograph.
What are the main science goals of the World Space Observatory?
The principal goal, as we see it, is to probe the cosmic web. One of the things that you can do very well in the ultraviolet, you can't do it any other wavelength, is to observe the intergalactic medium by using distant galaxies as background sources. And in particular, what we're looking for is helium that's been redshifted into the ultraviolet at redshifts of 3 or 4. And it's a regime that hasn't been probed by anybody so far.
So you also have a poster here at NAM. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, we've been using another UV mission called FUSE, the Far Ultraviolet Spectroscopic Explorer, using white dwarfs as background sources to probe the local interstellar gas, that gas surrounding the solar system within 100 parsecs or so. And this region is supposed to be a bubble or cavity that's been swept out in the past by some ancient supernova explosion probably 3 or 4 million years ago, and should in theory be full of hot gas. And that supposed hot gas has been used to explain the presence of the soft X-ray background. Unfortunately, what we find when we actually look along these lines of sight, that the hot gas that we see isn't actually in interstellar space, but is sitting in the stars, and that the region surrounding them is more or less devoid of hot material. And that means that it can't be generating any soft X-ray background.
So what possible other explanations are there for the soft X-ray background?
Well, there has been some speculation for a while that at least a component of the soft X-ray background comes from the heliopause, that region where the solar wind terminates and collides with interstellar space. And through a process called charge exchange, you can generate X-rays. There's been a pretty extensive debate about whether this is a viable mechanism for producing the soft X-ray background. It certainly can't produce it all. There will be an extra component from outside the local bubble. But what we see from nearby is probably produced by this mechanism.
That was Martin Barstow from the University of Leicester.
Okay, there are plenty of people wandering around. We've got 520 astronomers here. One of them is Chris Lintott, who is famous for being on The Sky at Night as the co-presenter. But he's also an astronomer himself. I talked to him earlier to find out about his area of astrophysics. Okay, with us now is Chris Lintott of Sky at Night fame, as the label that goes with you everywhere, I'm sure.
It is, yes.
Yeah. But you are actually a researcher in astronomy.
That's right, that's my real life, is as a postdoc at Oxford, working on astrochemistry.
So can you just tell us a bit about what you do in astrochemistry? Because I know you've been giving some talks this week.
Sure. It's a very simple solution to a difficult problem, which is if you think of where stars form in the universe, you immediately think of that Hubble picture of the pillars of creation.
So the big clouds of dust.
Yeah, the dark, dusty clouds. But that's all you get if you look at them in the optical. We want to see inside those to look at where the stars are either forming or just about to form. So to do that, you go to longer wavelengths. In particular, you use the submillimeter. It's the same frequency as your microwave operates on.
Right, the microwave oven.
Exactly. And what that does is it gives you the signatures of a whole series of chemicals which are associated with star formation. Some of them are familiar, like water, for example, ethanol, which you've probably come across once or twice in your life, and then a few strange things, hydrogen cyanide, And there are about 120 different molecules that have been discovered in space. And by studying these, you can get a huge amount of information about the physical properties of the forming star, but also about their history. What makes up the gas which is going to go on and form the star? How did that collapse? How fast did that collapse?
Yeah.
And all of this is encoded in those molecular signatures. Now, what I do is take models that people have worked really hard on for the last 30 years to explain Milky Way star formation and try and throw it out to the early universe, to distant galaxies, right, and see what chemistry can tell us about those.
Right, it sounds very interesting. But also, you do the sky at night. We have to ask you about the sky at night.
You're welcome to ask me about sky at night.
World famous sky at night. Tell us about the 50th anniversary, because that's this year.
And it is.
You had your special programmes quite recently.
That's right. It's been a great honour to be working. Well, it's always an honour to work on the programme. But for the 50th anniversary, this is something that I think people have been looking forward to for the last 20 years. So we desperately wanted to do something that felt like a celebration and which was fun while having a lot of astronomy in it. Because the sky, one of the things that people forget is that the Sky at Night's never been afraid to have a bit of fun with the subject.
Yeah.
If you go back through the archives, you find occasional things like Heather Cooper being projected onto a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, or Michael Bentine and Patrick being replaced by aliens. We wanted to have part of that tradition too. So we came up with this idea of looking 50 years back to the very different world of 1957, and then 50 years forward to the future as well.
And it's quite nice because it ties in with the launch of Sputnik as well. It was the same year.
You know, it was an incredible time 50 years ago.
It's National Geophysical Year.
Exactly. Yeah. This launch of the space race. There's obviously a burst of interest in astronomy as well, because I've had so many invitations this year and last year to talk at 50th anniversary events for local astronomical societies. So space was definitely on people's minds, even before Sputnik. Jodrell, of course.
Yeah, the Little Telescope was completed.
Years. And we wanted to get a sense of what that world was like, because it was very different from where we were now. If you look at what we knew, then it's almost mind-boggling. For example, take Mars. There was a serious argument that the dark areas on Mars had to be vegetation.
Was that still going?
Yeah, and it sounds ridiculous now, but the justification is very sensible. Mars is a dusty planet. Any features are going to get covered in dust. We know it has dust storms. So therefore, the only features that remain must be pushing up through the dust. What does that? Well, it's plants. Of course, that's the opposite to the real answer. It's the dark areas are areas where the dust has been blown away. But it's things like that that bring home how much life has changed in 50 years. Well, that in the dress sense.
it was quite fun watching that Sky at Night issue, and you had John Kilshaw, the impressionist.
That's right,
the young version of Patrick.
Yeah, that was a masterstroke. That was our producer's idea, Jane Fletcher, who never gets enough credit for everything that happens behind the scenes. But the first programme wasn't recorded. Some of the archive has been lost, but most of the early programmes were never recorded because tape and film were expensive. Plus, it was only television. Why would anyone want to watch television again? So
there's not been anything found in anyone's garden shed or anything.
We do have a programme from 1957, not a Sky at Night, but a programme called Frontiers, which was a general, very formal chat show with Patrick on it, discussing the RAF's attempt to produce a spacesuit.
And was that successful?
Well, it was an interesting design. I think it was in response. It was just after Sputnik. So it was a what will happen next type of affair. So it's interesting to see that world. And I don't think the basics of television haven't changed. You try and tell the story as clearly as you can, but not miss anything out. And that's what we're still trying to do. But to go back to John Kilshaw, so we had bits of archive, and we thought we could cobble something together and have Patrick interview the archive. So, so Patrick, what do you think about Venus? And get the archive clip from 1960 that says, well, Venus's day is very long, or whatever else. But we found out John Kilshaw is an amateur astronomer.
Oh,
and he's an amateur astronomer whose first ever impression was of Patrick.
Fantastic.
And we recruited him, and the moment when we had the two Patricks in the same room talking to each other was actually quite special. So John was a great spot. Patrick, who wrote most of the script, really, I think he enjoyed himself. But it was nice to have part of that world. Odd to see it in colour, because you forget that the people, if you're physically there, the people there were in colour.
They weren't all black and white or sepia, yeah.
Exactly. And then we wanted to go forward, because this is not the end of the Sky at Night. Our next anniversary programme, which goes out first Sunday in May, is the second half of the party, which is lots of looking back, lots of how was it for you, and lots of archive, which would be great. But we wanted to make the point, we're not stopping. We're planning June. And so
the next
we thought,
50 years.
Exactly. I want to go to the 100th anniversary party at the Sky at Night. So we skipped forward. But of course, Patrick still had to present it because this is a celebration of what he's done. So clearly,
he's the longest running continuous presenter, I think, in the world.
Absolutely, like yeah, and that record will never be beaten. There
just
won't
missed
be
one episode because of.
Of a duck egg
yeah.
or a goose egg. I can never remember which. It depends who's telling the story.
Right.
What happened there was that he was in hospital when we were supposed to be recording the programme. We recorded the programme without him. And luckily, by the time of broadcast, he had recovered enough to advise us on what we wanted. And the BBC offered to delay the programme for a week
right. So
that he could present it. And he refused because he said the programme was much more important. And that sums up his attitude to the whole thing.
That's a great attitude, actually. And I have to comment here that I think the BBC mess around with the Sky at night and they put it on an awful time. I'm sure you can't say anything about this.
I agree.
But they put it on an awful time of the night. I mean, I know astronomers are supposed to be up at night, but...
It is frustrating when you put a lot of work into something and then it goes out at 2 a.m. But, hopefully it matters less than it ever has done because people do record it. And, of course, you can see the last 3 years' worth of Sky at Night on our website, which is bbc.co.uk/Sky at Night.
And we'll put a link to that in our show notes
Excellent.
As well.
Excellent, good.
So people can watch online to all 3 years' worth of programmes.
Yeah, it goes back just a bit more than that now. We're coming up to 4 years of archive on there. It's only a small window, but you can hide it in the corner and get on with some work while listening.
Well, that's excellent. Thank you very much for talking to us.
A pleasure.
I don't know why they don't put it on at a better time. Just on, I don't know, 5:30 on a Saturday. There's nothing on.
Yeah.
Why not put, you know... Well, they have a slot on Sunday morning, don't they, when they put Countryfile on? I mean, come on.
Oh, Countryfile's got a good weather forecast.
Exactly.
But apart from
astronomy
that.
After that.
Do they not repeat the Sky at Night on a Sunday morning or something already?
It's on a Saturday morning on BBC Two.
Yeah, like morning lunchtime, isn't it?
But and it's repeated on BBC Three, I think, as well. Mm. On a Monday night, possibly. At a more reasonable hour.
But it is at least on the web, so you can always go and watch it.
David, you also talked to someone else. Tell us who they were.
Very recently there have been dramatic changes in the study of exoplanets. Now these are planets around other stars. What's happened is we've been detecting them through various means for quite a while, but other than knowing that they're there, we haven't been able to find out anything more about them because they're so far away. The star that they're going around is so bright in comparison, you're just being blinded, almost like trying to spot a little tiny glowworm on the side of a car headlight or something. You just wouldn't see it. But using some very, very interesting techniques and using eclipses, Peter Wheatley from the University of Warwick have actually managed to obtain information about the light that comes from planets. And so I spoke to him today, and this is what he had to say.
Could you tell me, Peter, what have you been doing recently?
Well, what I was presenting in my talk this week was data from a space telescope called the Spitzer Space Telescope, which is a NASA mission, which works in the mid-infrared part of the spectrum. And that's a part of the spectrum where the light from planets around other stars peaks. So it's our best opportunity to directly detect planets around other stars. The problem we have is that because these planets are very close to their parent stars, normal imaging techniques don't work. So you can't form a separate image of the star and the planet. So you have to find some indirect way of measuring the brightness of the planet. And the way we do that is we find special examples of systems where the planet actually passes across the front face of the star, blocking some of the light from the star. And then the amount of light it blocks tells us how big the planet is. But then half an orbit later, the planet goes behind the star. And at that point, we lose the light from the planet. So if we make very, very careful measurements with Spitzer, we can detect the brightness of the star apparently dropping by about 0.25%. That allows us to infer how bright the planet itself must be. This is the only way we have of measuring the brightness of planets around other stars.
And this is the first time this has ever been done?
Now, it's been done a few times. It's been done about 4 times with 4 different planets. Yeah, as I say, you need this very special kind of system where the planet passes in front of the star. Well, I was presenting results from a planet that was discovered by a UK mission called the SuperWASP program. And so we recently discovered two extrasolar planets with the WASP program. And I was observing one of these. It's particularly interesting because it orbits a star that's very hot, hotter than any other star of this type, that with an extrasolar planet. And so because the star's hot, we think it actually heats the planet. So we expect this planet to be one of the hottest of these extrasolar planets. And so what I was looking for was to see whether the brightness of the planet was higher, which would indicate that it is actually indeed hotter. And that is what we found. The planet itself seems to be about 3 times brighter than the only other planets we've observed at that wavelength. And that seems to be also possibly related to its temperature, but also possibly related to the actual chemical composition of the atmosphere. So the atmosphere is believed to be dominated by maybe water and carbon monoxide. There's also the possibility of titanium oxide in the atmosphere, and that can change the pattern of brightness at different wavelengths. And that's what we may have seen in this system.
What advances do you predict in the field of exoplanets when we have such telescopes as Herschel and the James Webb Space Telescope online?
The James Webb Space Telescope is particularly exciting because it's got a very large mirror, which allows us to look at much fainter systems and also smaller planets around brighter systems as well. So it really opens up a much wider range of extrasolar planets. And there's a particularly exciting mission being launched next year by NASA called Kepler, which is it's a space mission designed to find very small planets orbiting stars and transiting stars. And certainly those kind of smaller planets will need a much more sensitive instrument to measure their brightness.
What is the future of the WASP project?
Well, that's very exciting because we, as I say, in our first season, we had sort of a pilot program where we looked at we had sort of five cameras looking at the sky searching for extrasolar planets just for a few months. And we found two planets in those data. But since then, we've been spending over a year working with 16 cameras, scanning the sky for more planets. And we're just analysing those data at the moment. So the WASP consortium, which is made up of a whole range of UK universities, hope this year to be announcing of order 10 or maybe even 20 new extrasolar planets. And these are the special planets that pass across the front of the star and allow us then to measure the brightness of the planet using instruments like Spitzer.
Excellent. Peter Wheatley, thank you very much.
No, this is the first time that this has happened. And there is a little fleet of papers coming out, press releases, that because they think they can actually detect the light of the planet, they can get spectrum. And already people are saying that they can see things like silicon.
I was going to say that's when it starts to get exciting, when you can start to tell what's in the atmosphere of these planets.
Exactly, because people are looking for the telltale traces of life.
Like water and methane.
Yes.
Okay, so that's pretty much it for today. There's not quite so many sessions tomorrow, but we've saved a few interviews over for tomorrow, just to stop this from being about 5 hours long, really. Come back tomorrow for more. Meanwhile, if you have any feedback for us, send us some feedback via the website at www.jodcast.net. So, that's goodbye from all of us here at NAMM.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.